if I'm really hungry and I've had a really bad day and I've just had a fight with my partner and the cats ran away.
From the Department of Marketing at Deakin University, this is the Marketing Lab. My name is Paul Harrison and I'm a senior lecturer in the Department of Marketing.
And I'm Ginny Weber and I'm a lecturer in the Department of Marketing.
Food is something that we don't talk about a lot in marketing. And when we do talk about food, it seems to be in the context of eating certain types of food as a means to get healthy and to avoid obesity. And I think one of the things that we aren't great at doing in marketing is talking about food as something that can be enjoyed, that we can consume. And so this week's episode, we're actually looking at food and well-being and the marketing of food and how in different ways we need to be thinking about how we frame food for a broad audience.
I am very excited to be having this topic as one of our sessions and really excited about the speakers that we have and the things that they're going to speak to. Like you just mentioned, in marketing, we tend to discuss food from the lens of obesity, self-control. How can we make healthier choices? How can we choose the salad instead of the chocolate cake? How can we get people to reduce their food waste? It's all about this sense of guilt and shame or what we ought to do rather than what we can enjoy doing or how food informs our identity, our heritage, our culture, and social connection. And this goes into a really important metaphor that's come up in some of the social psychology research in the space of food that was in the back of my mind while listening to these guests and what they had to say about food. There's some work that looks cross-culturally and within culture in terms of how people think of their body and food in that dynamic, whether they think of their body as a car and therefore food is fuel for that vehicle, whether they think of their body more as a temple and therefore something to keep clean and nourish only with the cleanest foods, or whether their body is a tree that needs food to grow and nourishment, much like trees need sunlight and fertilizer. And research has shown that these three metaphors in terms of our body and food impact on how much we eat, the types of foods we eat. If our body is in need of fuel, then we give it more calorically dense food. If our body is something that needs nourishment, we're a little bit softer and kinder with our bodies, maybe choosing that chocolate cake sometimes, but also choosing the vegetables because we know it's good for us and we happen to like it.
So in this week's recording, which is from 2020, I spoke to Alice Zaslavsky, who is the culinary correspondent for ABC Breakfast. She's also was a former contestant on MasterChef, and she's just released a book in the last 6 months or so called In Praise of Veg. We also spoke to Maureen Kamau, who is the digital content producer at Deliveroo. So that's a really interesting area in relation to food. And Dr. Michaela Jackson, who is at RMIT University. She does research in communication, particularly in relation to things like social marketing, but her PhD was in the area of food marketing and how food marketers communicate to children. So I started by asking Alice how important food is in the well-being of community. And just so everybody is aware, it's a bit annoying, but for the first few minutes of this conversation, Alice was having a few issues with her microphone.
Well, I think food is one of the things within the kind of, I was actually just listening to a podcast today about, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It's pretty high up there. You know, we need to eat in order to function as human beings. But I think also for people to understand food more broadly, to understand it in context, to understand how they fit into food chain, or the choices that they make every day, you know, three times a day or however many times they eat every day, have an impact on not only their community themselves, obviously, but also on the planet more at large. I think that that idea, that notion that I talk about as food literacy and that's kind of being more commonly referred to as that is just as important as teaching people how to read and write.
Food is such a social part of life. Have you kind of observed that, Maureen, as a cultural kind of perspective? Have you seen how food fits into different cultures?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, food, I like to think of like food as moments that bring people together. And so like, even when you think back to any part of your childhood, even your day to day, food is a really big part of that. And, you know, it's a place where people meet, they discuss, exchange different ideas, but also that's the basis of like really getting to learn about different people. Like, you know, I'll give the context of like, I guess part of my work is that, you know, we have restaurants across different types of cuisines, and that variety and just seeing how each different culture contributes to, I guess, the richness of culture here. Food is a really big expression of that. Yeah.
And Michaela, how do you see food as a kind of way of communicating complex issues around communities?
So complex and so rich. And I think just listening to Alice and Maureen talk, I think food is so integral to culture, and food is really, I guess, a medium in itself in some ways, in the sense that you can use food to, you know, certainly my mother's family, Eastern European, you know, you express food, we express love through food type of thing. You know, I was talking to another colleague this morning in young children who are picky eaters, that can be a kind of a form of control even. So I think food is really kind of integral and wrapped up with communication. So I think it's also the flip side of that is the way we communicate about food. And I think connecting back to that idea around food and its relationship to well-being, I got this visual of like a seesaw, if you like, because I think food can really be something that's promoted as a means to achieving well-being, and certainly through the rise of kind of a, you know, a well-being culture, if you like, and social media influences. But then I think we're also very mindful of perhaps how some perhaps more questionable food choices might detract from our well-being. So, a really, really interesting kind of nexus and crossover between food and communication. My brain's going off.
And this is to anyone in general, but where do you think food marketing fits into this? So the marketing of food. Now, you know, I've done a lot of research in the area of food marketing, and one of our colleagues, Michaela Boyd-Swinburne, always talks about the obesogenic environment. So, you know, this idea that it's the environment that actually has quite a significant effect on the choices that you make when it comes to food. Where do you think food marketing fits into that argument of the well-being of the community?
I'm happy to jump in. I think it can be a pro or it can be a con, in the sense that, you know, food marketing, as I see it, the tools and techniques are largely neutral. So if you look between, say, commercial marketing and social marketing, which I think sometimes are kind of held up as, you know, a villain in the case of, say, your Coke or your McDonald's versus kind of your very much a health promotion and healthy diets and all the things that we know that we should eat, a lot of times those techniques and the principles are really the same behind them. So I think food marketing, it can be a double-edged sword. I think the broader question around food as business, connecting back to that theme, is really interesting as well, because I think food is such a multifaceted concept that, you know, back in the day, food was not intended to be a business. It was intended as a form of kind of nourishment and survival. As Alice said, it's pretty essential in Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So I think even that combination is really interesting, and it's not always smooth or not always a happy partnership.
No, really great points. And I really like the analogy of the seesaw, right? Because it's a balance between, you know, we cannot ignore the fact that, you know, while it was not the intention, obviously, to be business-based, but that is the reality that we live in. But then it's the onus is on us, right, to have the responsibility in how, you know, we put that information forward and not be misleading. I know there's a lot of conversation and debate even around the halo effect of, like, you know, certain terms that we use in marketing, right? Like if it's gluten-free, doesn't always mean healthy, right? You know, because chips are gluten-free, but you shouldn't be having chips every day, right? So it is really, I mean, like, and there's like, you know, everyone's, you know, yeah, I agree. Like I'm a fan as well, but like, it's about how do we responsibly curate our messaging and our marketing? And I think that also goes into that conversation around, you know, how we target people with the different messages that we put out in the market, right? Because if you do like a blanket, medium, for example, like TV has a lot of reach, you know, mass media generally. But then it's really, you have less control, I guess, in how curated the messaging can be. And so, for example, someone who, an adult versus a children, how they would perceive certain messages around food is very different. And so I think, you know, it does introduce that element of responsibility and the ethos of food marketing as well. Yeah.
One of the things about the episode I was in of Phenomenon with you, Alice, was the idea of helping children to understand how food marketing influences their behaviour. And I love the idea of the show. Can you actually tell us a little bit more about the program and why you wanted to do it?
Well, the program, for those who haven't yet, it's Phenomenon with an M, and it's not a typo. It's what we're trying to do is spark a phenomenon in kids by encouraging them to see vegetables in a different way and fresh produce in general now. So the project is funded by Hort Innovation, who are the research and development not-for-profit representing growers across Australia for vegetables, fruit, seeds and nuts. And basically they came to me and said, what would you do to make vegetables cool for kids? And having been a teacher and having seen the difference that it makes for kids to access information in the classroom rather than around the dinner table, I thought that the school environment would be a really great place to kind of encourage them to see vegetables differently. But I was also really mindful that, and this is something that you'll come across, you know, no matter, you know, within marketing, someone will say, we need to create an education program. And that's just like it, Paul, I'm sure you've seen it a million times. So what we try to do with Phenomenon is rather than go down the traditional path of this is the perfect plate, this is a food pyramid, these are the kind of what you should think about food. Instead, we're trying to encourage kids to have the tools to be able to make those decisions for themselves. You know, things like, as you say, media literacy, encouraging them to get curious about the history of certain ingredients and just kind of sparking that curiosity, because through curiosity, they will start to seek out new experiences within food themselves. So certainly, you know, that mention of responsibility within food marketing, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. And certainly within the kids space, particularly, kids are very much black and white in the way that they think about the world. So a lot of the nuance that adults are very happy to accept within food marketing does not compute for kids.
So can you also kind of help us to understand how that program particularly used a whole range of different tools to communicate the kind of behaviour change, but also behaviour solidification in a way?
Yes. Well, we talk about within the teaching circles, we talk about that as scaffolding. So once you give them the information, you scaffold that knowledge so that it becomes just part of their everyday consciousness, I suppose. So something that I'm really proud of with Phenomenon is that rather than trying to get teachers to find space in their curriculum to suddenly start teaching food, which a lot of well-meaning people just say, well, why don't we just teach more food in schools? That's because everybody has their own agenda. So, you know, someone might say, well, why don't we just teach more cyberbullying appreciation or, you know, things like that. So
Financial literacy comes up all the time. Exactly right.
So yeah. Rather than doing that, it's about finding the gaps in the curriculum. Actually, I should probably contextualize this as well. In Australia, there's no such thing as a set curriculum that kids learn. Teachers are given a framework like a bookshelf, and then they choose what books go on the shelf. So what we're giving them is a free digital toolkit of lessons across maths, English, history, geography, art, science, lessons that they would teach anyway, but they're so engaging and so kind of forward thinking and digital, and there's videos and podcasts and very much human centered in the way that we've designed them, that what happens is that kids are kind of more likely to learn about mathematics better, and food just happens to be like a bonus.
I want to bring you in, Michaela, because your PhD came up with this three-dimensional model of consumer harm in integrated marketing communications. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what that means?
For sure. So I guess there's a bit of a sort of a segue to that. Absolutely, I guess, recognise and appreciate the value of education in its different guises. And I think it's I'm very supportive of food literacy and marketing literacy and financial literacy and all those sorts of things. I think the other thing that we need to factor in, which sort of is the segue to the model, is the fact that so much marketing is, as Paul said, incidental or subtle, or it works on non-rational processes in the sense that I know probably an average to above average amount of information on nutrition and fitness, etc., and I still eat unhealthy food because I'm not rational, and I think most people are not rational, and we're influenced by our environment and by our peers as well. So the three-dimensional model that Paul mentioned, which Paul and I are co-writing a chapter about at the moment, it basically looked at, okay, well, what deems to be wrong with the issue of unhealthy food and beverage promotion to children and adolescents? So junk food marketing to kids, as it might colloquially be known. So I had a look at this issue in both in terms of kind of popular discussion, so how it's talked about in the news media as well as in the academic literature. And I figured out that a fair amount of the discussion was around the, I guess, drawing back on the old, ye olde four Ps, the product, the nature of the product, the nature of the promotion or the marketing communication, and the audience. And there are a whole bunch of models that have looked at some of those variables and other variables, but they tend to kind of make a really black and white judgment and say, you know, products are either good or they're bad, or promotion or advertising is either rational and therefore it's good, or irrational and therefore it's bad.
But and you actually find that a lot in the public health space as well, don't you? Even in the public health space, you know, like you and I, and I'm sure others have kind of come across this thing that public health people talk about the evil, and it is very black and white, and it is, like you say, much more nuanced than that.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's about, first of all, recognizing that nuance, that I think a lot of these examples and these manifestations of marketing communication around food fall into that shade of grey. And also realizing as well with vulnerability, even though we might talk about vulnerable communities, we are all vulnerable in some way and at different points in time. If I'm really hungry and I've had a really bad day and I've just had a fight with my partner and the cats ran away, I'm probably going to be more vulnerable than, you know, if I've woken up and I'm well rested and all the rest of it. So that's, they're all kind of shifting spaces and shades of grey. The other thing too that the model does is through this kind of fuzziness, it's actually designed, or I guess it embraces the fuzziness, so that people have a conversation, so that I can say to, you know, a food marketer, look, I think this is really bad. And they might say, really? I don't think it's that bad at all. And through that conversation, and there's some research to indicate that contemplation and conversation can actually lead to kind of more ethical outcomes. So I guess sometimes fuzziness can be a good thing. So
there is a real tendency to in business to think about things in a very black and white way, or a very kind of binary way. Something, tell us what we are allowed to do, don't tell us. And when we kind of go back to, particularly to food companies and things like that, to say, you know, a principled-based approach, they really struggle with that. Food marketing, and when I say marketing, I mean all of those P's, including the product itself, has really evolved over the last couple of years. Mm. You know, as we've kind of seen food marketing evolve, where do you think that fits in with this idea of food as a form of community, food as an important part of, you know, people defining where they fit within a community?
No, that's a great question. And I think, well, one, the whole aspect behind, you know, the delivery aspect of business really is about bringing in the convenience and making it easier for people to get what they want, stroke need, when they want it, in the way that they want it. And I guess that's kind of the undertone of the culture that we are in right now, right? Like, we're kind of I heard someone refer to it as a microwave generation. So we like things that are quick, easy, quick to access. And so I would say that in terms of how we fit into that whole food marketing place, so one, there's the aspect of the product. And for us, the product is obviously what is available on the app, right? So like if you go into the app, what variety of selection do you have? How far reaching is it, et cetera? And then, you know, you talk about who are we targeting? This is pretty much anyone who has a smartphone or access to the internet, anyone who's hungry, right? And so I think one of the principles that we really stand by is that there's this idea of food freedom. So it is the consumer's choice at the end of the day, right? So we provide the variety and that degree of access. But ultimately, there is that food freedom that, you know, you probably don't want to eat a salad every night. But if you do, it's available and we have that selection for you. Or you don't want to eat, possibly, you know, that you shouldn't eat fries every night. And so like there's a whole lot of variety, but for when you do, there is that availability. And for us, it's not necessarily pushing a particular choice onto consumers, but it is creating that awareness and giving a platform, not just in those two extremities, obviously, of like junk food and, you know, what is on the opposite end of like more considerably healthy food. But when you think of bringing in the aspect of different cultures, I mean, what we have done is open up people to a whole new like variety of things that they probably never had available to them. So for example, if I've never had Greek food before, and I probably wouldn't know where to get it just because that's not necessarily in my everyday thing, having the options, I think that makes for bringing people I think more together and bringing in that diversity as well. And it could be a great way to like expose yourself to more of what's out there. And I think what we do, even in terms of our promotion, is that we try and one, really bring out that awareness, but also let people know that it really is about your choice at the end of the day. And I think I like what you said about the ambiguity, right? Like the tools and the platforms and the app, it's not good or bad inherently, it's neutral, right? But it is how we use it and it is how we push it to the consumers at the end of the day.
Can we work a little bit with the way that the human body responds to food? And I'll come to you, Alice, as well. Is that ultimately the human body is desperate for sugar, fat and salt, basically. How do we overcome those things and eat, you know, obviously you've got a book coming out called In Praise of Veg. As my daughter always tells me, vegetables would have evolved not to be eaten. That's why they don't taste good. They don't want to be eaten. But there's no reason for them to exist. Where fruit is sweet because, you know, you're spreading the seeds around and things like that. If the foods that are ubiquitous are ones high in sugar, fat and salt, how do we help people to make these choices? And I hate using the word better because again, that's full of value judgment, but you know, how do we help people to make choices?
Yeah, I think I'm really glad that you bring that up, Paul, because the language that we use around food is very loaded and we don't even notice when we use this language ourselves. And I think vegetables are a victim of some terrible, bad, they've just had the worst PR for way too long. Yeah. And if you think about, say, the microwave generation actually has a lot to answer for with vegetables, because what happened was that for a few generations, vegetables, which were for a long time the only source of nourishment for a lot of people because they were easy to grow, you know, subsistence farming vegetables you could grow, whereas, you know, hunting wouldn't have been as possible or as often. But then in the 20th century, outcome, you know, we've got a glut of veg, we've got less and less time, particularly as women started going to work. And so in went the veg, on went the timer for a couple of hours, and then you come back and you've got overboiled Brussels sprouts, you've got stinky cabbage, and nothing tastes good. And so we now have multiple generations that have had that experience. And so the way that we sell vegetables, and I'll come back to kids because that's kind of the question that I'm often asked, how do I get my kids to eat more vegetables? The way that we deliver that message is already pre-programmed in our minds to be a narrative around trying to get them to eat healthy or trying to get them to eat better, or even just the notion of trying to get them to eat anything, right? Mm. So my suggestion there is to throw all of that out the window. So let me show you my book, actually. It's somewhere.
Where is it?
Oh, here's what I prepared earlier. All right. So... So this is my book, In Praise of Veg. You know, it's fat. It's a big fat book. But the reason why I wanted to kind of show you is, first of all, what you'll notice about it is hopefully you see that it doesn't have any kind of expected, you know, smiley at salad me, or there's not so much green, right? It's a lot of bright color. It's a lot of, look at that. That's kale chips, right? Mm-hmm. Glossy, sexy, colorful. What vegetables need is a rebrand. So rather than the number one thing that I would say is stop trying to tell people that vegetables are healthy, because our expectation, and you all know this because you're in an MBA already, so you know this stuff, our expectation of flavor goes down as soon as the word healthy is put in front of anything. So rather than thinking about vegetables as healthy, certainly you can say, you know, they're nutritious or any of that sort of stuff, or even don't even say that. Know it for yourself, but don't say it to people when you serve it up. Describe it in other ways. So whether that be these crispy, crunchy, chili flaked, salty kale chips, you know, burn your brassicas, learn how to cook vegetables better, and don't load yourself up with the guilt and shame that comes with feeling like you need to eat healthy, or even using the word diet, right? That word in itself, you know, from an etymological perspective, diet is basically just what we eat, right? Mm-hmm. But it's been hijacked really by food marketers to sell us more stuff that we probably could cook quicker and easier and more deliciously at home. We just don't yet have the tools or the access.
This also kind of comes to the point of, you know,
I'm off my soapbox now.
It does come to a point where you enter into any interaction with any object, any social object, any attitude object, with a degree of preconceived belief. So whether it's 100%. Vegetables, whether it's, you know, burgers, whether it's, I don't know, anything really. Mm. Consumers are not empty vessels. They bring with them an autobiography of all of their learned experiences to help them to make those judgments about what they should and shouldn't do, and the decisions that you should make. And I think you're right, the vegetables need rebranding. The problem with that is that there isn't one company you know, in charge of vegetables. There's not the Brussels sprouts company. And remember,
can I just chime in here? And I actually think that there has been a bit of a shift with that in terms of your superfoods. And I think, you know, it can be done. And I just look at kale and go, this used to be the vegetable that butchers would use to display their meat because it was kind of tough and green. And I just think that's a success story in terms of vegetable branding. You know, if we can get people happily eating kale, then I think, yep, it can be done. So I think, you know, superfoods certainly have issues attached to them in terms of, you know, do they stack up? But I think those sorts of things have been a positive shift, and maybe there needs to be kind of more veg getting on the kale bandwagon, if you like.
And maybe there's also that classic thing in marketing, which is a big part of this, is it's about getting people to try something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the attitude, behavior, consistency model, which is that you've tried something, you've liked it, now we have to encourage you to keep trying these things, and then it just becomes normal. I wanted to kind of go to something, Maureen, you know, that you've explored, which is, you know, your work with African communities and things like that. But actually in the context of food, how do you introduce a white culture like Australia to a food culture which is, you know, unfamiliar? And it doesn't necessarily have to be African or anything like that. I mean, you know, when I was growing up, spaghetti bolognese was classy.
One of the ways, I think, encouraging trial. So one, give me a really good incentive as to why I should try this thing. You know, if I feel like I'm having to climb Everest to get this new experience, then that's not something I'm going to go for. And so just being really clever in the nuances that we put things forward, you know, would be a really good, a good place to start. I think we like to think we're very different, but we're very the same. So if we talk about, like, you know, different childhood experiences or family or food occasions, they would be pretty similar. It's just introducing a new element to that.
In general, how do we do emotion in the digital world?
So one of the things that I think is essential, and I think as much as we are, we find ourselves quite disconnected. The good thing is that we do have the tech that allows us to connect in new and different ways. And so I think having very open conversations and providing spaces where there is that two-way dialogue rather than people talking at each other, because I find that a lot of times in conversations online, people are like, I think that we're almost like on guard all the time. And so if someone says something that slightly contradicts maybe what we think, or we feel that they're attacking us rather than giving a difference of ideas. But I think the more we encourage what I'd like to call safe spaces, to have more of these conversations that, you know, oh, this is how we do things here, and you doing things differently where you're at doesn't make it, it's not good or bad. It's just different, right? And so I think it's one of those things that you kind of have to work through the teething problems. For example, like with brands trying to talk about issues to do with, you know, touching on diversity and things like that. It is a bit of a tricky one, for example, yeah. Right?
Trying to, and it like, can be tokenistic as well.
Oh, yeah, it can be very tokenistic. But then the, what I'll call stick-to-itness. It's not the most academic word, but like...
I like it. You should patent it. Trademark it.
Yeah.
I've heard of stickiness in a marketing context. Oh, yeah. That's the difference.
So. Yeah, so the ability to stick to it despite the discomfort and despite, you know, something being not something that you're used to. That's the whole idea. That's how new ideas come about, right? Is that one person says it and it gets people like, oh, I'm not sure I'm comfortable with that. That doesn't sound like what I'm used to. But you start to hear it enough times and start to have open dialogue, then I think it becomes more of a conversation people want to take part in. But if I'm talking at you or listening to respond online, then that could be, you know, it goes wrong. And we've seen many examples with brands like, you know, it takes just one tweet to demolish your entire brand, right? So that's one way I would think about it, is that being able to have that same uncomfortable conversation over and over again, but providing that safe space for, like, knowing that not everyone's going to agree with you.
What responsibility do you think the food industry has towards consumer well-being? And we can go with whoever wants to go with the first thing. That's a big question. But do they have any responsibility? Some businesses would say none, because it's all about consumer choice. People are rational. They can make choices. At the extreme end, you might have, you know, people like some of our colleagues in public health, Michaela, who might go, it's all their responsibility. And then, you know, somebody falls in the middle. So maybe... Michaela, you start.
Yeah. So my initial response is massive. Like, I think food companies do have a massive responsibility. And I think it, I'm very interested in notions of kind of power and subtle power. And I think massive, I would say, in this day and age, in the sense that the day and age we live in now, there are some very, very large food companies globally around the world who have an enormous influence on what we eat and how we kind of feel about food. So I think that's not to say that amount of responsibility perhaps that they have is the same as kind of your very small kind of brand or organisation. But I think there's this idea of kind of the social contract in terms of, as a society, we kind of agree for businesses to do their thing and to make money, so long as they're, I guess, not creating harm for society. And I think it can be difficult sometimes to weigh it up because, you know, even if you have something like a McDonald's or a KFC, okay, maybe not all of their food products that are that great in terms of nutritional value and long-term health if you consume them of a high amount. But, yeah, they actually create a lot of jobs for people. They actually contribute a lot of money to the economy. It's not kind of all, again, clear black and white. But I think there is a big degree of responsibility, and I think food companies increasingly have realised that responsibility to different extents still. There are some who I think take it more seriously than others, but I think there has been pushback around the contribution of kind of food to the wellbeing of society. So, that's my take on it. I think, yes, we do.
Oh, sorry, go on.
I was going to say, I think, yes, you know, it does come down to personal choice and personal responsibility, but I don't think that that is necessarily an even or a fair choice. So that's one point. And
And it may not be pure. I think that's the other thing. Is that, you know, what we all know is that much of our decision making is not pure. It's not a rational process. So the concept of choice is often framed in a very rational frame when in fact it may not be. And I think bringing in power is a really interesting one. Alice, your thoughts on this idea of the responsibility? Go.
I hope you could see my face, Paul Harrison, because I was having some feelings, Scott, of the worst poker face. the best thing that I will say is that certainly food companies have a really they do have responsibility, and they've got a lot of responsibility when it comes to how much money they're making out of us by selling us their products. How they exercise that responsibility, or how they meet our expectations of what they'll do, I am very skeptical when it comes to the CSR projects that are undertaken by some of these companies. So I'm going to give you two examples. One of them is one that I personally have some knowledge in, and the other one is one that I've heard from a couple of parties. So I'll tell you the one that I don't know as much about first, because the other one's a smoking gun. So in terms of the personal choice versus responsibility of food companies, if you look at a lot of the dietitians and nutritionist conferences that are sponsored around the world, a lot of them are sponsored by your Coca-Cola Amatils and your Nestle's. And what you'll tend to find is that those nutritionists that are sympathetic to those conferences, that are the keynotes, tend to speak a lot about personal choice. And they tend to speak a lot about calorie in, calorie out, because that sort of messaging is very helpful for the companies that are selling us stuff that they want us to ingest the calories of, right? So I think that that's something that we need to be really skeptical about and care and just sort of look out for, I suppose. And if you do find yourselves working for those companies, I don't know, I'd be really curious to be a fly on the wall in those meetings when those decisions are made. Now, in terms of my own personal experience, part of what I'm really proud of with Phenomenom is that a third of our funding, it's funded by government and industry. So we've had around $2 million worth of funding to date. And a third of that funding has gone towards consumer insights and looking at what it is that what our program is doing and reiterating it to match. So the first round of insights that we got once we did our first sort of Phenomenon block, which you were part of, Paul, was that we tested it against a control program that's in schools at the moment. Again, it's another free program. It's it gets heaps of like fantastic press, and they get send out backpacks to teachers and those sorts of things. And it's known as Healthy Active Kids, and there's a brand in front of that. Mm-hmm. And so that was our control group that we tested. And what was really interesting is that we were testing the language associations that kids had towards vegetables when they watched our videos versus when they watched the videos of this Healthy Active Kids program. And what we found, first of all, is that the kids that watched, the beginning points were really the sort of stuff that you'd expect kids to parrot. So vegetables are good for me, I have to eat them, and they're healthy. So what happened when they had exposure to our videos is that it went to, they're interesting, they're fun, they're exciting. That was really exciting for us. But what happened when they watched the other one is that they went to yuck, boring, and don't want anything to do with it sort of thing. And so that was, from one exposure of a video that's supposed to be designed to make kids want to eat it. So what's going on there? Beyond that, we also tested parents' responses to these videos. And what we had was the parents' association of a cost. So vegetables are inexpensive was where they started. When they watched this Healthy Active Kids program, it went to vegetables are expensive and too hard to work with. Right. So is that an accident? Or is that something that has been intentionally, insidiously designed to reframe the values around the way that these kids are seeing fresh produce and moving them towards? So one of the things that they were valuing was vegetables are colourful. What else is colourful, right? So it's just, that really worries me. And I do think that there's some massive you know, gun power in terms of the money that could be put towards some really positive messaging with these companies. And I really believe that there are some people that want to do good in them. I've met plenty of them. So how do we encourage more of that, and how do we kind of steer them in the right direction?
Some really fascinating thoughts coming from our guest speakers on this recording. And I agree wholeheartedly that there are so many people in these systems who want to do good, and so much of a movement in society right now towards thinking about food from a healthy place, but not just healthy in terms of nutrition, healthy in terms of our relationship to food and the emotions surrounding food and what consuming really means to me as an individual.
It's a really interesting field because everybody has to eat. So it's not like a product that you can say, maybe I don't want to buy it. It is the product where everybody has to make choices. So it is very much a need as opposed to a want.
And I think that that is a bit of a wicked problem for society to face more generally than just food. At the same time, when it comes to those choices, having the ability to have an emotion forward, a well-being forward choice that isn't couched in purely guilt and shame or picking the thing that is fuel for the body, but picking the thing that will make me feel the best right now and in the long term. Sometimes we need to eat the vegetables. Sometimes we really do need to eat the chocolate cake. We're having a hard day and we need to give ourselves the space to do that. And I think coming back to the conversation from our guest speakers, focusing on the messaging that we can give to children and teaching them to feel good about what they eat and how what they eat makes them feel good would be a really great starting point.
I think well-being is often couched or framed in the context of, in a way, denying yourself something, as opposed to well-being will have a different meaning at different times for different people. And you're exactly right that sometimes a piece of chocolate or a piece of chocolate cake is exactly what the body needs for well-being. Even if you think about the way that we frame anything that makes us feel good, we tend to say, this is my
guilty pleasure.
Guilty pleasure. I mean, as if pleasure is something we should feel guilty about. I think it's interesting how food has become one of those kind of guilty pleasures.
It is a little bit strange, especially when you think about those connections with identity and culture and heritage that come in. Food is not, I mean, it is a need, but it's not only a need. It's also something that we use to connect to our own personal history and past and to our families. And it's a shame that we've been taught to feel shame or guilt around connecting to our heritage and history and to other people, because it's very important, again, to well-being, but to what we get out of life more generally.
One of the things that we talked about in the second part was this idea of how marketing seems to be so driven by convenience and how we've removed the concept of discomfort from our normal lives.
I actually have very strong feelings about this notion of convenience at the, you know, sacrifice of all else and the importance of learning to sit with discomfort. Ruminating on it quite recently, thinking about how if you never experience discomfort, then the discomfort that you do experience to you is the most painful or worst thing that could ever happen. You end up losing a little bit of perspective in terms of, wow, this guy is 10 minutes late delivering my food. This is awful. When in reality, it's not that awful. And it breeds this emotional sense of I'm entitled to comfort as opposed to I'm resilient to discomfort, leading us potentially to have negative emotions that arise that we never really learned how to cope with.
Do you think that marketing has basically just built on a natural predisposition of humans to avoid discomfort?
Even single-celled organisms move away from frightening, painful stimulus and towards ones that are better for them. Marketing is just tapping into a very base thing about our biology, which is that we prefer pleasure over pain, and has found a good way to give that to us over time, possibly almost a little too well.
And I think in that conversation in part two, we also discussed the idea of, is it marketing's role to behave responsibly? What's your take on that?
That's such a difficult question. My answer personally is yes. I believe in praxis in terms of ethicality in our actions, in the way we design systems. I think to the extent that marketing is part of society, marketing is a system that owes itself to society, is beholden to consumers and to citizens and to people in the world, it has to at some point take responsibility for what it does and perform in at least somewhat of an ethical way.
So with that, we'll leave you waiting for the next episode. Thanks again for your involvement, Ginny.
Absolutely. Don't forget to hit like, subscribe.
Yes, and leave us a review on whatever podcasting app you're using. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you again in 2 weeks' time.